All right, skipping along and still continuing in the same thing. John is again asking Candy if she can see Jensen and what he has to say. Candy says, "I don't say anything. I just listen. He is telling us all the truth. I know it's true because of all those pictures they show us, and it was disgusting." John, "Who gave you the pictures?" Candy, "They didn't give them to us. They showed them on the screen. They were up there, all those black men with white women. It was revolting, disgusting. Those white women going after the black men. It's going to be a bad scene." John, "It's a bad situation, huh?" Candy, "It sure is. It's all true." John, "Is that what they're teaching in the organization?" Candy, "They show you." John, "Is that what the CIA, what Dr. Berger taught you?" Candy, "Marshall said that everybody knows a white who's going with a black. He said it is going to be some big problem. Marshall said that it is going to be tough on the children and that they should be sterilized. I think that's so." "And that's what Berger taught you?" Candy, "Uh-huh." Becoming vehement, "They should be sterilized. They should not be allowed to bring in children. They should stick to their own kind. Does a tiger mate with a lion?" John, "Was that what Dr. Berger said?" Candy, "He sure did." John, "Is Dr. Berger paid by the CIA? Candy, "He is the CIA. He's important out here in discussions, but I don't know how big he is." Okay, now, skipping from the control of Candy Jones and back to another book.
Well, in evaluating this, I think there are a couple of things. First of all, if the things we've presented so far haven't scared you, I would think that this would. Candy, at least according to this account, was not a bigoted individual, and yet was turned into a real hater, and a hater of a number of different people, Jews, Italians, blacks, all kinds of people. And I think it's worth taking note of in this context that, at least to a certain extent, I think, to the extent that the federal intelligence agencies, the U.S. government, is involved in programming people in this fashion, it represents, maybe the ultimate legacy of the Galen organization that we've talked about, where Nazi war criminals were brought into the country, incorporated into the intelligence system, and, they say big oaks from little acorns grow, and this would appear to be at least one of the trees that sprang up from that particular Nazi acorn. And it's worth noting here, too, note the stereotype and foul attitude towards black people, because the mental faculties of black people and the CIA and federal government's efforts to control black people and to effect mind control on them were a major, major focus of activity. And we're going to take a look now at some material indicating that a proposed center, which was going to be opened in Southern California during the Reagan administration, might have been used for effecting mind control on blacks. We're going to read you a section here from a book called The Mind Stealers, subtitled Psychosurgery and Mind Control. It's authored by a man named Samuel Chavkin, Chavkin. It's copyrighted 1978, published by Lawrence Hill and Company in softcover.
Okay, now bear in mind also that this area that we're talking about right now, the author of The Mind Stealers is talking about a particular thing that was going on in the early 70s. However, that quite a bit of this is still going on. A lot of these things are still on the books. There are still people pushing for these kinds of control. And, this is not something that just because they're talking about the early 70s, something that's evaporated from the scene. As a matter of fact, Jack Anderson has printed a number of columns in the last couple of years about people in the Reagan administration talking about early screening for potential criminality in poor children and things like that, things that the current administration, that fringe elements thereof supposedly are pushing for. Anyway, once again, reading from Samuel Chavkin's The Mind Stealers. "The development and acceptance of the idea of pinpointing those who may be potentially assaultive or crime-prone because of genetic, hormonal, or brain abnormality received major impetus during the Nixon administration. The Nixon general staff was determined to sweep away the, quote, permissiveness of the 60s, in which social and economic factors took center stage as the prime causes of crime and disquiet. Their view, at least as publicly stated, was that there was ample opportunity for everyone to make it, socially and economically, and that those failing to do so had something intrinsically wrong with them. Quote, shape up or be zapped was to be the motto of the new generation. This was also the Nixon attitude when dealing with the civil protest disorders that continued to break out immediately before and after the assassination of Martin Luther King, Jr. It was in this climate of heightening demands for a better deal by the minorities, on the one hand, and the law and order frenzy, on the other, that three Harvard professors, Dr. Sweet, Dr. Mark, and Dr. Irvin, put forward the proposition that riots and civil disobedience may be sparked by individuals who, unfortunately, may be carriers of damaged brain cells. When under stress of such emotionally high-pitched confrontations as street demonstrations, these people will run amok, become assaultive, and precipitate acts of violence. The Harvard trio presented their view in a letter to the Journal of the American Medical Association, which appeared under the headline, quote, Role of Brain Disease in Riots and Urban Violence. The letter, in part, follows.
The development and acceptance of the idea of pinpointing The poverty, unemployment, slum housing, and inadequate education underlie the nation's urban riots is well known. But the obviousness of these causes may have blinded us to the more subtle role of other possible factors, including brain dysfunction in the rioters who engaged in arson, sniping, and physical assault. It is important to realize that only a small number of the millions of slum dwellers have taken part in the riots, and that only a subfraction of these rioters have indulged in arson, sniping, and assault. Yet if slum conditions alone determined and initiated riots, why are the vast majority of slum dwellers able to resist the temptations of unrestrained violence? Is there something peculiar about the violent slum dweller that differentiates him from his peaceful neighbor? There is evidence from several sources that brain dysfunction related to a focal lesion plays a significant role in the violent and assaultive behavior of thoroughly studied patients. Individuals with electroencephalographic abnormalities in the temporal region have been found to have a much greater frequency of behavioral abnormalities, such as poor impulse control, assaultiveness, and psychosis, than is present in people with a normal brainwave pattern. These conclusions lead to a variety of questions. Is the activist just a violence-prone slum dweller? Is agitation for civil rights tantamount to impulsive pathological symptomatology? Is docility or acquiescence to slum conditions a sign of emotional health? Is this theory to serve as the scientific rationale to justify putting politically conscious ghetto protesters into the same category with muggers and murderers? And I'd like to repeat that last sentence and have you think about that in connection with Candy Jones and also some material we're going to present a little later. Is this theory to serve as the scientific rationale to justify putting politically conscious ghetto protesters into the same category with muggers and murderers? And still later, again reading from The Mind Stealers by Samuel Chafkin. Soon after their letter to the Journal of American Medical Association, Dr. Irvin and Dr. Mark published their book Violence in the Brain, which expanded their theory to include the possibility that there were as many as 10 million Americans wandering around the country who suffer from obvious brain disease, unquote, and an additional 5 million whose brains have been subtly damaged, unquote. They thus provided compelling data for the need to start a program for mass screening of Americans. Quote, Our greatest danger no longer comes from famine or communicable diseases, they asserted. Our greatest danger lies in ourselves and in our fellow humans. We need to develop an early warning test of limbic brain function to detect those humans who have a low threshold for impulsive violence. Violence is a public health problem, and the major thrust of any program dealing with violence must be toward its prevention. A couple of points here. The limbic system is a portion of the brain which controls primarily appetitive behaviors, hunger, sex, and so forth, and is connected with such things as violence. Also, the doctors referred to here, Dr. Vernon Mark, Dr. Frank Irvin, and Dr. William Sweet, all three of them Harvard professors and very obvious advocates of mind control.
Okay, now what Dr. Sweet and others were advocating very strongly in front of, among other things, Senate hearings, committee hearings on appropriations and other things, was the starting up and funding of diagnostic centers to sort out those people who might imperil society because of their brain abnormalities. One center that they were planning was being planned in Ronald Reagan's California at the time he was governor. Now, you'll remember earlier in the broadcast I made a passing comment about the fascinating return of coincidence that we see time and time again as we study these kinds of things, and how these people always seem to wind up in each other's hip pockets. You're going to hear a name mentioned in this next section, Dr. Louis Jolyon West. Dr. West, besides the things that we're going to talk about in this article, also just happened to be Jack Ruby's psychiatrist and happened to be the man who argued on Ruby's behalf that Jack Ruby didn't really mean to shoot Lee Harvey Oswald. He just happened to be in the Dallas police station with a gun and then had a sudden attack of psychomotor epilepsy that forced him to pull the trigger, silencing the one man who might have been able to answer the questions about the John F. Kennedy assassination. So anyway, it was Louis Jolyon West who was Jack Ruby's psychiatrist and who basically was trying to get Jack Ruby off on the grounds that it was a total accident that he killed Lee Harvey Oswald. Okay, again, reading from the Mind Stealers, and they're talking again about these particular diagnostic centers. The Center for the Study and Reduction of Violence was to be set up to develop, quote, behavioral indicators, profiles, biological correlates to assist, quote, school administrators, law enforcement personnel, and governmental departments to detect and control, quote, overt expression of life-threatening behavior by identifiable individuals and groups. The proposed center was to be under the direction of the prestigious Neuropsychiatric Institute of the University of California at Los Angeles, UCLA, to those of you out there who like those initials, and it would be the prototype for other such facilities in different parts of the country. It was to be funded jointly by the state of California and the LEAA, which is the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, no longer in existence. For the first time in the history of the United States, criteria were to be set up for the labeling, or stigmatizing, it says in parentheses, of individuals believed to be potentially criminal, even though they had committed no crime. It was also astonishing that the program was so blatantly rigged against those sections of society that were the most vulnerable and least able to defend themselves. For those to be drawn upon for experimentation would be children, minority group members, and prisoners. Formation of the UCLA Center was announced in September 1972 by Dr. Louis Jolyon West, director of the Neuropsychiatric Institute and chief architect of the overall plan. An affable, plumpish man in his early 50s, Dr. West is an adventurous psychiatrist who somehow appears in the headlines more often than most of his colleagues. Known as Jolly West, he came to considerable prominence as the very young director of the psychiatry department at the University of Oklahoma. It was there that he overdosed an elephant in the Oklahoma Zoo with LSD. Skipping down to the footnote, it says, there appears to be no connection between this zoo incident and the recent CIA revelations. At the time this book was written, they were talking about the revelations that the CIA had done LSD testing on human beings. But according to the New York Times of August 2, 1977, Dr. West was asked to make a study of LSD in relation to the CIA behavior control experiments. The New York Times reported that Dr. West was paid by the Geschichter Foundation, an organization allegedly used by the CIA to disperse funds to finance behavior research. So, we find out, before we go back to the article itself, that before any of this had happened, that the man who has turned out to be Jack Ruby's psychiatrist had also been working for the CIA on behavior control modification. Ronald Reagan, then governor of California, hailed the Center for the Study and Reduction of Violence. He gave his official blessing in his January 1973 State of the State Address. Reagan's Secretary of Health and Welfare quickly made known that, quote, more than $1 million would be invested in the center in the fiscal year 1973-74. Part of the subsidy was to come in the form of matching funds from the LEAA. As stated in Dr. West's original proposal, quote, a major thrust of the center's work will move into the largely unexplained interface between biological and psychological aspects of violent behavior, unquote, with the main lines of investigation focused on the genetic, biochemical, and neurophysiological factors.
And still later in Chapkin's book, the most frightening part of the proposal dealt with brain screening. In this connection, critics charged that Dr. West undoubtedly received a good deal of help from Dr. Irvin, who had moved from Harvard to Dr. West's Neuropsychiatric Institute at UCLA. The Center prospectus listed Dr. Irvin as one of those who would be directly involved in the development of its program. In introducing this concept, Dr. West echoed the Mark Irvin theory by stating that, quote, approximately 5 to 10% of the population suffers from some impairment of brain function. The proportion is probably much higher among inmates of prisons and institutions for the criminally insane, unquote. He went on to say that, in some patients, outbursts of uncontrolled rage have definitely been linked to abnormal electrical activity in deeply buried areas of the brain. For many years, neurologists have measured the electrical activity of the brain with electrodes attached to the scalp. Now, by implanting tiny electrodes deep within the brain, electrical activity can be followed in areas that cannot be measured from the surface of the scalp, unquote. The future looked even more promising, Dr. West declared, and it is even possible to record bioelectrical changes in the brains of freely moving subjects through the use of remote monitoring techniques. Now, we're going to tell you a little bit more here about Dr. West and just what sort of a site he picked in order for his particular project.
Before Dave tells...
Okay, now, as to just where Dr. West had proposed to have his Neuropsychiatric Institute located, and keep in mind his connections to Jack Ruby and the CIA through the LSD experiments performed under MKUltra, we're going to read you from a book called Mind Control. Mind Control was authored by a man named Peter Schrag, S-C-H-R-A-G. It's published in hardcover by Pantheon Books and copyrighted in 1978.
All right, now continuing again with the subject just dealt with in the last book, which is Lewis, Jolly, and West and the Center for Diagnosis, the Diagnostic Centers proposed by Irvin Mark et al. And on January 22nd, Schrag writes, 11 days after Reagan's speech and 2 days after Richard M. Nixon's second inaugural, West, that's Dr. Lewis, Jolly, and West, followed up with a friendly letter to his friend J. M. Stubblebein, M.D., then the state's director of health. Dear Stubb, the letter starts, I am in possession of confidential information that the Army is prepared to turn over Nike missile bases to state and local agencies for non-military purposes. They may look with special favor on health-related applications. Such a Nike missile base is located in the Santa Monica Mountains, within a half hour's drive of the Neuropsychiatric Institute. It is accessible, but relatively remote. The site is securely fenced and includes various buildings and improvements, making it suitable for prompt occupancy. If this site were made available to the Neuropsychiatric Institute as a research facility, perhaps initially as an adjunct to the new Center for the Prevention of Violence, we could put it to very good use. Comparative studies could be carried out there in an isolated but convenient location of experimental or model programs for the alteration of undesirable behavior. Such programs might include control of drug or alcohol abuse, modification of chronic antisocial or impulsive aggressiveness, etc. The site could also accommodate conferences or retreats for instruction of selected groups of mental health-related professionals and of others, e.g. law enforcement personnel, parole officers, special educators, for whom both demonstration and participation would be effective modes of instruction. My understanding is that a direct request by the governor or other appropriate officers of the state to the Secretary of Defense, or, of course, the President, would be most likely to produce prompt results. Although West's letter did not specify precisely what sorts of, quote, undesirable behavior he had in mind, how the, quote, alterations were to be accomplished, or why a, quote, securely fenced Nike missile site would be appropriate, the general objectives of the Violence Center had been extensively outlined in West's earlier proposals.
And a little later on, Schrag talks about some of the institutions which were going to be backing Dr. West here. This was far more than just a state institution. West had ample reason to expect support. He had the backing of the governor and the state's health and welfare agency. He had received promises of cooperation from a number of California prisons and mental institutions. He had many staff members who had long pursued independent research programs on life-threatening behavior, unquote. And he had secured tentative approval for a grant of $750,000 from the U.S. Law Enforcement Assistance Administration through the California Council on Criminal Justice, and for another $250,000 from other sources. He was also hopeful that other funds would be provided by the National Institute of Mental Health, which, like LEAA, had become increasingly interested in developing effective technologies of behavior control. Now, it's worth noting that this center was never established, and there was a storm of protest, which Nip is going to read you about in a second. We're going to engage in a little bit of speculation or rumination about just what about some of the events that might have sprung from this, however.
Indeed. Continuing with mind control. And yet, despite all that, The violence center never really managed to get underway, never got the Nike missile site, and never got its funding. The proposal was too ingenuously blatant, and the timing, which seemed so right in the winter of 1973, the season of Nixon's last and greatest triumph, appeared all wrong a few months later. Protests that began early in 1973 among students and faculty on the UCLA campus, among them several members of Jolly West's own staff at the Neuropsychiatric Institute, reached the California legislature, which threatened to investigate, and which blocked the state funding, which had been so certain a few months earlier. The decision, said Earl Bryan, Reagan's Secretary of Health and Welfare, represented, quote, and mind you, he's talking about the decision to block the funding. The decision, said Earl Bryan, Reagan's Secretary of Health and Welfare, represented, quote, a callous disregard for public safety. Meanwhile, partly as a consequence of pressure from civil liberties organizations, LEAA announced that it had banned the use of its funds, quote, for psychosurgery, medical research, behavior modification, including aversion therapy, and chemotherapy. So, in 1973, we find that the violence center and its proposed Nike missile-based site is turned down, mainly because, as so often happens, people found out about these things, and when people do find out about things, that seems to be the only way some of these things are ever stopped. Otherwise, it probably would have been ticking promptly along.
Now, a couple of things to take note of in the passage Nip just read you. First of all, you heard a reference to Dr. Earl Bryan, the California Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. I believe that was his title, or Health and Education. At any rate, Dr. Earl Bryan was very close to, among others, Ed Meese, who was Reagan's legal counselor. And Earl Bryan's name surfaced in connection with the legal tangle surrounding Ed Meese. Remember, his name is now being put in nomination again for being Attorney General, the highest law enforcement official of the land. And basically, Dr. Earl Bryan was one of the people involved in the financial shenanigans around Ed Meese. So this is a connection which goes on to this day. Now, in the year 1973, which was the year that the Neuropsychiatric Institute project at the Nike missile bases was turned down, that was the very same year, interestingly enough, in which a fellow named George Philip Blakey placed down the initial $650,000 deposit in Guyana for the People's Temple. Now, the People's Temple moved from California, where it began, down to Guyana in 1973, in this year, and a number of people have suggested that when the official plans for the study for the prevention of violent behavior down at the Nike missile bases were turned down, that perhaps the state and the federal government turned to Jonestown, and it's some of its intelligence connections we're going to talk about, we're going to hear about very shortly, that basically they simply switched their attentions to Jonestown.
Now, unfortunately, due to time constraints, we're not going to be able to cover all of Jonestown tonight, probably because Jonestown, the story, has gotten so vast since the initial events. Probably we're going to maybe even be carrying Jonestown over to yet another in the series of Radio Free America broadcasts on mind control. However, we are going to indeed introduce you at least to the beginning of the Jonestown story, because, again, looking at what had happened in California at that time, and by the by, these were not isolated incidents, at the same time as we're talking about Dr. Louis Jolly West, who had been working for the CIA and was Jack Ruby's psychiatrist, while Louis Jolly West is putting together his violence center proposal and talking about working with poor people and prisoners and things like that, we have people like Colson Westbrook, a previous CIA agent, going into the prison systems of California to work with men like Donald DeFries, who later became Field Marshal Sin Q, leader of the Symbionese Liberation Army, who then proceeded to kidnap William Randolph Hearst's daughter and brainwash her. Numerous other incidents of collaboration or a strange collusion between the intelligence network and the SLA and other acts of terrorism going on in California at about this time, the early 1970s.
Interesting connecting link. F. Lee Bailey, who was Albert DeSalvo, the Boston Strangler's attorney, also represented Patty Hearst, and the whole question of brainwashing and mind control became front and center in the Patty Hearst trial. There was a lot of speculation that one of the reasons why this daughter of privilege, so to speak, went along with the SLA was that she had, in fact, been brainwashed. And the Patty Hearst syndrome is receiving a lot of discussion even to this day in connection with hostages. So let's recap a little bit about some of the things that we've looked at here. Now, we took a look at Candy Jones, a CIA courier who was basically being programmed to hate black people. We then looked at the efforts of Irvin, Mark, and Sweet, who basically said that, well, some blacks riot and some don't. Perhaps the ones who riot have a neurological deficiency in the brain. We better study it. Then we see Lewis, Jolly, and West connected to both the CIA, connected to Jack Ruby and the Kennedy investigation. He, along with some of the Harvard team of Irvin, Mark, and Sweet, are going to set up this Center for the Study of for the Prevention of Violent Behavior. And chief among this, one of the chief foci of their investigation was, again, to study black people and to find out why some of them, quote, run amok, unquote. Now, recall that the People's Temple, only the leadership was white. The vast majority of the People's Temple was black. Recall also that Jim Jones became, among other things, the housing commissioner of San Francisco, that Tim Stone, when he was a DA up in Ukiah, basically was responsible for getting a lot of people who were from mental patients, orphans, people who were otherwise wards of the state, into the People's Temple. And we see tentacles from the People's Temple running into some of the same institutions that were being talked about in connection with the UCLA Institute.
Again, and something that will be covered in greater depth undoubtedly when we deal with Jonestown on a longer basis, perhaps in the next Radio Free America. Jim Jones also had connections to the previously mentioned Dan Mitrione, who, among other things, was down in South and Central America at the time that perhaps the early days, schemes for Jonestown were being laid down. As we mentioned earlier, Dan Mitrione was the former Midwestern police chief who went to work indirectly for the intelligence networks and the CIA and was teaching the police and security forces in Uruguay and Brazil and other places essentially how to torture and how to brainwash and how to terrorize the local populace for the purposes of establishing and perpetuating the quote-unquote national security state. So bear some of these things in mind. We'll be talking about them again at more length. However, we are going to take a short break before we play the tape, at which point we can come back and introduce it.
One thing I think is worth mentioning is let's take a look at some of the California connections here. Now, both Gilbert Jensen and Marshall Berger, who were the two controllers and programmers of Candy Jones, were located in California. Although she was based in New York, she flew to California for her programming and for most of her instructions. And now, of course, the whole Robert Kennedy case took place out here. Notice that James Earl Ray apparently went down to Los Angeles, and that's where he became involved with hypnosis. We've taken a look at the Neuropsychiatric Institute down there, their proposed study for the Center for the Study of Violent Behavior, and that, of course, was going to be down in Southern California. And, of course, Ronald Reagan and Dr. Earl Bryan are from California. Earl Bryan hooked up with Meese.
Don't forget Artie Bremmer and his sister.
Arthur Bremmer and his sister, and of course the People's Temple was from California initially. The Symbionese Liberation Army, of course, was from California, and I think it's worth mentioning here, too, that the first researcher in the country really to focus on the California connection, on the terror, and on mind control specifically was Mae Brussel, whose work is featured on this station, and Mae basically was the first also to suggest that perhaps the UCLA Center, the Center for the Study and Prevention of Violent Behavior, was simply moved down to Guyana under the auspices of Jim Jones. Also, a little bit about the chronology of Jim Jones. Jones was in Brazil in 1962 at the time that Dan Mitrione was down there teaching torture. They were childhood friends, apparently. They'd grown up in the same town. And while Jim Jones had taken his, I guess you'd call it his People's Temple Roadshow, he studied Father Divine, a very famous black evangelist who made a great deal of money achieved a lot of fame and power as well. And Jim Jones studied his techniques and the various scams that Father Divine used. And apparently, it is impossible to pull one of these things off, one of these scams off, where you sort of pull these circus tent tricks of pulling a cancer out of somebody's mouth or nose, it's actually a piece of liver, without the cooperation of the local authorities. And Dan Mitrione was police chief was sheriff in Bloomington, where Jim Jones was doing some of his work. I'm not sure exactly which city Mitrione was chief of police in, but much of Jones' work was done in that town, and by implication, probably involved a little bit of cooperation from Dan Mitrione.
All right. So once again, before we play you this tape introducing the Jonestown segment, which obviously, as we said before, we're not going to get to all of tonight, but we are going to get to the tape. But before we get to the tape, just to put this all in proper chronological order, Dave and myself are going to take a short break. So don't go away. We still got some more information. And then about a half an hour after that, after we get back, when the tape ends, we will be opening the telephone. So once again, this is Nip Tuck with Dave Emery saying stick with us, and we will be back for the rest of the information segment of Radio Free America in just a moment. Back to Radio Free America. This is Nip Tuck with Dave Emery here in the studio. And just to explain to you what's going on, we were kind of free-forming this section of the show tonight. We weren't absolutely sure offhand what we were going to do here. And what we are going to do, again, is go ahead and play this segment of a press conference given by Leo Ryan's press aide, Jill Holtzinger, talking about the events at Jonestown and allegations thereabouts and thereof.
By the way, that town was Evansville, Indiana, where Jones made his start, okay? Not Bloomington, but Evansville. Now, there are a number of intelligence connections that the People's Temple had. Eventually, we'll be in the next series, next part of the series that we're doing on mind control, we're going to go into some of these alleged cults like Jonestown, the Unification Church, and so forth. Eventually, we're probably going to do a whole Radio Free America show just on Jonestown, because it's a massive story. But in connection with Candy Jones' programmed race hatred, in connection with the proposals to study why some blacks riot and some don't, and by implication to go into their brains and mess with them, in connection with the Neuropsychiatric Institute, and in particular that the year in which the Center for the Study and Prevention of Violent Behavior was turned down was the same year in which George Philip Blakey, a CIA employee and very close to the Layton family, who you'll hear about, that was the year in which the People's Temple got going in Guyana. Now, you're going to be hearing a press conference given by Jill Holtzinger, I believe it was on May 23rd of 1980. And before that, you're going to hear some tape, and by the way, a production credit here goes to Eric Siegel from up at KALX, our sister station up in Berkeley, who helped put this together. And you'll actually hear a little bit of Jim Jones sort of exhorting his People Temple followers to kill the people who were threatening them. And it's really interesting to hear. So before you actually hear the conference, you'll hear a little bit of old Jim himself. Doing his thing.
Okay, and once again, before we start, just want to let you know this tape is approximately 30 minutes, more or less. So somewhere between, say, quarter of and 10 till we will be coming back, and at that point we will be opening up the phones at 415-941-2500 for you to comment on anything we talked about tonight or in the last broadcast in the series or anything else that seems germane to the issue. So once again, about half an hour, and we will be coming back for your phone calls at 415-941-2500.
But don't ever say hate is your enemy. Love has practically caused me to just get you destroyed. If I had hated a little more, just a little more, we would have had a little less trouble. Because I look at my faults analytically. Sure, you got to love.
Jonestown, Guyana.
But don't say hate is my enemy. What did they say? What's that word? Hate is my enemy. I got to fight it day and night. And what else is that? The line. Love is the only weapon. Martin Luther King died with love. Kennedy died talking about something you couldn't even understand, some kind of generalized love, and he never even backed it up. He shut down. Love is the only weapon with which
this is the voice of Jim Jones.
I got a hell of a lot of weapons to fight. I got my claws. I got compasses. I got guns. I got dynamite. I got a hell of a lot to fight. I'll fight. I'll fight. I will fight. I will fight.
On November 18, 1978, more than 900 people allegedly committed suicide at Jonestown, leaving 200 other people still unaccounted for to this day.
Let them hear it in the night!
Of those 900 people, the vast majority were either shot, strangled, or had injection marks on their shoulder. Contrary to what the established media said at the time, very few died from self-administered cyanide Kool-Aid. The Jonestown Massacre was precipitated by the visit and consequent murder of the late Congressman Leo Ryan of San Mateo.
Let the night roar with it. They're out there. They're out there. They're listening. Let the night roar with it. Roar, 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 roar.
Let the night roar, because they can hear us. They know we meet. We'll kill them as they come.
In 1980, Joe Holsinger, one of Leo Ryan's aides, began investigating U.S. government intelligence links to Jonestown. He disclosed some of his findings at a press conference later that year, which was taped by Pacifica's Larry Bensky, then with Inner City News. In just a moment, we will play that tape for you, the listener, on Hard Rain. Joe Holsinger.
I had appeared on a public television several months ago with a group of black professionals, mostly psychologists and doctors. They invited me to appear today to provide information that they thought might be that I might be able to help with this forum today, with their research. I appeared in Washington in February before the International Relations Committee and made some statements and some charges and documentation, which resulted in the Foreign Affairs Committee, or International Relations Committee, whichever they call it today. They voted to ask the House Select Committee on Intelligence to investigate my charges. And they are currently investigating those charges by the House Select Committee on Intelligence.
Can you tell us what the charges are?
Well, the charges basically amounted to CIA contact with both the Burnham government there and with the People's Temple. That originally, it was my belief at the time I went to Washington that the purpose of our involvement there was to support the government of Burnham for commercial reasons, and they used the People's Temple almost as enforcers to help support an unpopular government there to keep control of the government of Guyana. We knew that there had been an article in the San Mateo Times in December of 79 which indicated that the deputy chief of mission there, Richard Dwyer, was in fact the CIA station chief. He was the one that went to Jonestown with Leo's party, and he claimed to be slightly wounded, but there was a tape made at the time of the murders and suicides there with Jones yelling, "Get Dwyer out of here, get Dwyer out of here." And the indications are that it was Dwyer who went back into Jonestown after Leo was murdered and was there at the time. And there's great question is just who shot Jim Jones and why, whether Jones was shot to shut him up. The question also as to how all these people died and just when they died, which is all documented here. But soon I came back from Washington because of my testimony. I started getting documentation from a Berkeley psychologist called the Penal Colony here and from the Alliance for Preservation of Religious Liberty in Washington, which indicated other things, one of which was that George Philip Blakey was a top Jones aide. He was the man who arranged the purchase or the lease of the land in Guyana, provided the money and arranged the lease down there in 1974. He also was tracked now as being a CIA operative in Angola in 1975 with UNITA. He's also the same guy who was a top aide who arranged all this purchase and the finances, is also the husband of Deborah Leighton Blakey, who fled Jonestown and made those charges. He's a brother-in-law of Larry Leighton, who was acquitted yesterday. And it's interesting to note, the Peninsula Times Tribune says yesterday, the jury acquitted, in acquitting Leighton, the jury appeared to have agreed with the defense contention that Leighton was brainwashed and drugged at the time of the shootings, could not be held criminally responsible. But the gist of what I'm getting to is this. I received a lot of documentation, which I will provide you to hear today, that indicates the strong possibility that Jonestown and the People's Temple was in reality a mass mind control experiment conducted by the CIA as a follow-up to something called MK Ultra, which they conducted from the early 50s through 1974. They used to use the VA hospital and state hospitals. They used the federal and state penitentiaries for their experiments.
Do you think that Jim Jones was actively involved with the CIA?
I do now.
Would you elaborate?
Let me read you one quotation. I'll read this at the end. It's a quotation from the book The Strongest Poison. But we had reports before Lee went down to Guyana that Jones had given $1 million to Burnham. There was another connection was between Burnham and Jones. We thought it was based on money. We don't know where Jones got all that money. We know, for example, that Jones spent at least 9 months down in Brazil, I think it was. It was either in the late 60s or early 70s, after which he came back with the money to start the Mendocino operation of the People's Temple. And we're starting to have the linkage between... we have Blakey, who was his top assistant, one of his top assistants, over in Angola with the CIA. We have Dwyer down there, the station chief of CIA. They had a covert operation. They had to have a, with Dwyer, they had to have a covert operation which was not reported to Congress. Now, the Hughes-Ryan Act of 1974 said they had to report all CIA covert operations to the oversight committees. That was Leo's legislation. He co-authored that. There was no such report of a covert operation in Angola, in Guyana, meaning, I brought this out in Washington, one of the things they're checking into in Washington now, that the CIA broke the law if it had a covert operation there and did not report it to these oversight committees. So what we have here is, Leo goes down there, and the question is, was Dwyer there? Dwyer came here from Thailand. He was with the CIA since 1959 in Guyana. We have photographs of Dwyer with his arms around Marceline Jones and Jim Jones out there. We have Jones. We have Dwyer going back to Jonestown after Leo's shooting, and Jones getting wiped out. And what we're trying to... We now have an admission back with the Senate Intelligence Committee, for example, that they now admit that Dwyer was CIA and is CIA.
If Jonestown were...
What I'm doing is this. You're asking a question on CIA and the definite involvement. They always deny... They denied that Dwyer was a CIA agent when I first charged it. They now admit it. They only admit what you can prove. We have here a copy of a document called Who's Who in the CIA, one of these attachments here, listing Dwyer as CIA since 1959 and where he's been.
Well, let me get back to my original question. I asked you, since you made the statement that you felt the CIA was using People's Temple as an experiment.
My question was
Jim Jones aware of it? Was he part of that experiment?
If that experiment existed, because I'm saying to you that this possibly is a strong possibility in race. I'm inclined to believe it. I can't be sure, but I'm saying yes, that if such an experiment was there, Jones would have had to have been part of it and would have had to have led that experiment. Let me read to you this one statement from Jones, which is quoted in a guy... I hate to give you the source because it's the book The Strongest Poison by Mark Lane, and I know that Lane has lied in other parts of his book from personal experience. But there's a statement here, which you can read here, about Jones' claim that he was a true and loyal and patriotic American. If the terrible regime was obligated to remain in Guyana, and the world people would never know what a patriot he was. This is a statement from Jones, down in Jonestown. So what I would like to have you do, this is what I'm doing here, is very difficult for me to sort of shorthand this much documentation, but all I'm really doing is suggesting to you that I'm making this statement today to this forum. I've asked them to take the documentation I've attached to consider going in and viewing this data and conducting a further investigation on their own, especially in the black community, among survivors, among relatives of that, to see what elements they can find there, to either corroborate or disprove these statements about the mind control experiment in Jonestown.
Do you see any significance in the fact that Jones did his recruiting and had his temple in the black community insofar as an experimental situation that the CIA might have been involved in its concern?
I'm not sure that he started there deliberately. I think it's possible, more likely, that he had something going already, a church going, and that if they were going to try to use cults or religious groups for this experimentation, they may have looked around for likely candidates who were already in action, already in operation. And they may look at somebody who was a charismatic leader type. And I don't think that he was started off this way. I think they may have watched his career and then decided to approach him. I think it would be more likely that he was already underway.
Do you have any conclusions as to how the people died in Jonestown?
Yes, I have part of our documentation here. Is a report from which is attached here. The chief medical examiner in Guyana is a Dr. Leslie Moto. He reported, and this is attached here, his opinion that more than 700